corner closest to the Paddy Gym. I guess all geographers should be able to find Northwest. There's just one comment that I would like to make before we call on the individual speakers, and that is to note the fact that our knowledge of the physical aspects of Arctic environment is to a very large degree the result of work which the military agencies have supported over the period of the World War II and in the 20-some years since that conflict. And it's not always appreciated, I think, by at least the present generation of students, that the military has supported science quite generously for many years. The great drive on support of science by the military, of course, has been since World War II, but it's been traditional with the Navy, the Army, and the Coast Guard to support research and to carry out expeditions and make it possible for scientists to get into the field. And this service by the military has been of tremendous importance to Arctic and Antarctic, all polar research. The type of research that the military has supported has been, to a large extent, perhaps engineering type of work, but very broad programs in basic research have also received support. And I feel that the students who revolt against the support of research by the military and the universities really do not have a very good perspective of the manner in which the military has supported broad basic research and assisted scientists in many ways. The first speaker of the morning is Lawrence R. Mayo, a hydrologist with the United States Geological Survey, located here in Fairbanks, and he's going to present a precipitation map for Alaska. Mr. Mayo.
There seems to be a real need in understanding Alaska's environment today to get at the whole water balance equation for the whole state. There is a lot of work presently going on all parts of the water balance equation: total precipitation, total evaporation, changes in storage, and the surface and groundwater runoff. The precipitation data that has been taken up to the present time has come mainly from the U.S. Weather Bureau at stations located at airfields or points of habitation in the state, which are generally in the low-lying valleys or right next to the seacoast. One could expect that any precipitation maps based solely on that point data would be biased quite low, and that has indeed turned out to be the case. The Weather Bureau is very aware of this problem, and on the map, on precipitation maps, it's generally stated that they are not to be safely interpolated in mountainous areas. Well, Alaska does have a lot of mountainous areas, and we have to start dealing with them now to get at the total water balance picture of the state. To start on this water balance equation, the first part of it is the input precipitation. The easiest precipitation map to start work on is mean annual precipitation, because it seems to be least variable as far as location goes over the state. In other words, you're not dealing with individual storms. You're dealing with a very long-term averaging of statistically random things. The precipitation map that I'm working on is not yet completed. It's still in its formative stage, but at this time, we'd like to show you what has been accomplished and show you the status of what might be considered now a hypothesis. The map has many problems that should be ironed out. Possibly field data collection can be used to either verify or alter sections of this hypothesis. May I have the slides, please? Yeah.
Get the lights.
Is this the light switch? Most of the precipitation data of the state comes from the standard U.S. Weather Bureau stations. This one is at Anaktuvuk Pass. You're familiar with the type of gauge. It's an 8-inch orifice surrounded with a windscreen. There are big problems in measuring precipitation with gauges in windy environment, and this windscreen is one attempt to start solving this problem. It's not entirely successful. Now, I have a series of slides showing various types of gauges that have been used in the mountainous areas now to supplement this Weather Bureau data from the lowlands. Next slide. This is the glacial high mountain environment that all precipitation maps say that you should not operate or should not interpolate into. As you can see, there's an awful lot of snow piled up in these regions. It's piled up from mainly wind-driven snow, which is next to impossible to gauge. Next. This wind-driven snow, as you can see here, will blow and blow and blow for days and days. There may be several meters of accumulation in large flat areas, but in slightly exposed areas, such as where this hut is, no accumulation ever forms. So average precipitation in the mountainous areas has to be an average of large areas that relatively irons out these small knobs, kettles, valleys that either get no precipitation or 10 times more than what would be average for, say, 1 kilometer area. Next. Part of the Geological Survey's program in Alaska has been to wax up our cross-country skis and really get at measuring the precipitation in the mountains. This long snow probe rod is used to go completely throughout basins, mapping the snow depth. This is multiplied by snow density to get the annual snowpack. This in itself is a partial record of the annual precipitation. And we quickly found out that just the winter snowpack far exceeded the precipitation shown on some of the maps. Next. We have installed year-round precipitation and air temperature gauges in the glacial alpine environment. The precipitation collects in a storage tank after going through an orifice with an alter windscreen surrounding the orifice. The windscreen is very important to help control the airflow past the orifice. Without a windscreen of such a design, you can get absolutely no catch during times of extremely heavy precipitation. The homemade Stevenson screen on the left-hand side contains an air temperature bulb that records on the same chart. So this station is a year-round recording air temperature and precipitation gauge, modified from existing stream gauging equipment. Next. This shows a close-up of the windscreen. The baffles are slatted and movable so that the ice and rime that accumulates on them can be beaten off just by wind action. The upper surface is horizontal, and the whole effect is to reduce the amount of wind arcing up over the orifice. Next. The standard rain can just simply won't work in this environment. You can leave it out all winter and go there and there's nothing in it. To supplement the snowpack data on the glacier surface, I've designed this gimbaled precipitation gauge on a triangular frame. As the frame melts down with the melting snow and then with the melting ice surface, the gimbaled gauge stays upright simply by gravity. Next slide. Other types of precipitation gauges we put out are 2-inch diameter steel pipes on non-glacial areas. The small diameter orifice is used because the amount of wind arcing over the orifice is very small. The momentum of a snow particle or raindrop coming toward this orifice is more important than the wind arcing, so the catch is pretty close to true. Next. Snow pit data is also a good form of precipitation data. Again, it's not annual total precipitation, but it's part of measuring the annual total precipitation. Between these two dirt horizons in the accumulation zone of a glacier, you can see how much snow is left over after the entire melt season. This is that amount of snow left over after the end of the melt season turns out to be more water equivalent than is shown on present precipitation maps, indicating very graphically that the present maps need altering. Next. This is in the interior continental climate with reportedly meager precipitation. This is a 5 meter deep snow pit, a snow density of about 0.5 kilograms per liter. So as you can see, in this interior climate, there are places that have exceptionally high precipitation. This is in the accumulation zone of Galkana Glacier in the Alaska Range. Next. Another way of measuring precipitation is coring deep cores with an aluminum coring auger. Next slide. In addition to the precipitation data, precipitation from any region can be checked if one knows something about the evaporation and something about the stream runoff, because precipitation minus evaporation should equal stream runoff for areas without storage. The Geological Survey operates over 100 stream gauging stations, all variations of this theme, where we do get annual runoff data from small and large basins throughout the state. Next slide. Putting together the whole water balance of a mountainous region, altitude versus meters water equivalent per year, the rain and snow on the top part of the graph are a summary of pre-1966 precipitation data from the interior, and you can clearly see that although the data is fragmentary in terms of time, there is a very marked increase of precipitation with altitude. Since we have more gauges in the Alaska Range now, we have verified this curve exactly. On the lower side are the losses from the basin, the perennial ice ablation, rain runoff, and snowmelt runoff. Lead to the total runoff, which is the heavy black line. The total runoff from high altitudes is less than from lower down because there isn't as much melt up high. But again, I think you can see that the mountainous environment is hydrologically much more active than the areas below 500 meters altitude, such as Fairbanks. There, the annual precip and runoff is very small compared with the higher mountains. So, now, all of this water balance information, partial record from snow pits, various types of newly designed gauges installed in the mountains, are all leading to a revised picture of what the total precipitation is of the state. Next slide. Now we get to another kind of data that can be used for precipitation maps that is not as precise. It's harder to use. The interpretation of this data is subjective. One has to consider the processes that are going on. In short,
there are various things such as storm tracks, the distribution of vegetation, the distribution of snowpack as one can photograph it or as it shows up on aerial photos, just the gross distribution of glaciers. All of these items can lead to pattern information that shows you how you should shape the contours that do go through the point data of precipitation. This is very important because it leads to a contour map that at least is not overlooking some important principle, such as running a very low precipitation contour through a maritime ice field, such as the Harding Ice Field, or running very low precipitation contours through an area that has glaciers discharging into the ocean. All of these things should be taken into account, and when put together, are very helpful in at least shaping the contours. The climatic zones of the state shown here roughly resemble the gross vegetation pattern of the state. Southeastern and south central Alaska has a hemlock spruce forest. Everybody knows that it rains hard there. Farther west, it's still a maritime climate, but as you go around Alaska, the amount of precipitation keeps decreasing, although the climate is basically maritime. In the central part of Alaska, there's a very different vegetation type. It's a spruce with no pine, no hemlock. There is quite a bit of permafrost present, and it's generally a region of quite a bit less precipitation than the coastal areas. The arrows show the most common storm tracks in the state, and this is an accumulation of years and years of storm track data. There are some secondary storm tracks that come in the interior, but as far as dumping in precipitation, they are minor compared with these storm tracks. Next. Another type of pattern data is simply noting when and where snow occurs. This is in the coastal mountains of the state this year in mid-June. Snow is present quite extensively down to altitudes as low as Fairbanks is right here, which is a very apparent indication that lots of precipitation occurs in that area. At the same altitudes in the interior, there's no snow. Next. The pattern that, the pattern that large snow drifts in the mountains make, you can see these very large snow drifts in the accumulation zone of Gulcana. I have mapped through part of the state. These large snow drifts form exactly in the direction of air mass movement during the time that snow is falling. The flow map that is derived from mapping the snow drifts gives one a very good idea of which side of mountains or large mountain islands are the rainy side and which side are the rain shadow side. Another type of pattern data. It hasn't previously been considered a part of precipitation data, but it is useful in helping to shape the contours. Next. The snow drifts, the stippling pattern in the upper part of the map, have been mapped for several areas now very precisely, and we've measured the precipitation and ice balance on them, so we know what these snow dunes mean. This type of mapping the direction is then carried just with vector arrows to large areas of the state. Next. Next slide, please. The final result is a precipitation map that accumulates about 250 annual precipitation measurements at points with fairly reliable gauges. Another, at least 100 short-term precipitation gauges that haven't operated throughout the whole season. A lot of these have been operated by the Army, the Air Force, by university research projects, by the Forest Service, other agencies, all had a scattering of precipitation gauges around. Okay. There are 117 stream gauging stations that have been... Oh, could we have that last slide back, please? 117 stream gauging stations have been used. The evaporation of 1/10 of a meter on the tundra areas, 2/10 of a meter in the interior, and 4/10 of a meter has been used for the coastal areas. And the resultant precipitation map unfolds as this. In the southeastern area, there's as much as 8 meters of precipitation on southern Baranof Island. The coastal areas receive in general 4 meters of precipitation in the mountains and less at lower altitudes. The Alaska Range has a little bit of 2 meter precipitation per year and strong precipitation shadows behind it. Several interior basins such as the Copper River Basin, the Tanana Basin, and the Yukon Basin have less than 1/4 meter per year annual precipitation. Then in the Brooks Range, where there are glaciers, there is probably around 1 meter precipitation, and the coastal plain has less than 1/4. So very simply, the state is 4 meters of precipitation on the coastal mountains, 2 meters on the Alaska Range, and 1 meter in the Brooks Range, with lesser amounts in each of the precipitation shadow areas. This map is going to be worked on further, and we have no set publication date for it, or we don't even know how we'll publish it. But this is the status of our thinking now, and we're working on it as a hypothesis.
Thank you, Mr. Mayo. Are there any questions for Mr. Mayo? I have one that I would like to ask. It has been assumed on theoretical basis that there is a zone of maximum precipitation on the mountain slopes of particularly windward mountain coastal areas, that in the higher mountains, the lower temperatures and hence lower absolute humidity would result in less precipitation at the highest elevations and some maximum precipitation at some lower elevation. If I read your graph correctly, you show an increase in precipitation with elevation.
Yes, there's quite a bit of field evidence to support that right now. And all of the areas that that's been found are at a higher elevation than the top of that graph, above about 2,500 meters altitude, or 7 to 8,000 feet. The precipitation does start decreasing. And one of the main factors controlling this decrease on up on the higher mountain peaks is just the snow that's blown off them. That I think may be even more important than the decrease of humidity. But it is true that the higher mountain peaks probably receive less precipitation. This map, though, is averaging large areas of maybe 20 or 30 kilometers square.
Any other questions? Yes, Mr. Brewer.
Yes, that's true. The snow data from the Arctic slope has been accumulated mostly by Carl Benson here at the university. We did some measurements this spring, and most of the good snow water equivalent data that we have averages quite a number of points, since there is a high variability, as you pointed out. The assumption that the density of new fallen snow is 0.1, is fairly valid for snow that has not sat around for very long. For very newly fallen snow that will rest on a table, that's quite valid. Now, the snow that you're noting with a density of 0.3 or 0.4 has been blown around and rested on the surface. The Weather Bureau doesn't use that snow and multiply it times 0.1 to get precipitation.
I think we'll have to go on to the next paper. We're running over our time. Is Ms. Steele, Nancy Steele here?
No, I'm reading the paper.
You're reading her paper. And what is, I'll let you introduce yourself then, since I was asked to announce that messages and mail are at the reception desk in the lobby of this building. So check for mail at the registration desk.
Thank you. Mrs. Steele is unable to attend the meeting, so I'm reading her paper. She's done quite a bit of the laboratory work in this subject. Snow and ice surfaces in the polar regions, the Antarctic and the Arctic both, have been commonly used for campsites, travel routes, and runways. Generally during the winter, when it's cold, these surfaces are really no problem. In the summertime, especially in the Arctic, but even in the coastal regions of the Antarctic, warmer air temperatures and increased solar radiation cause a lot of melting, a lot of deterioration of travel routes, runways, and campsites that can become quite a problem, especially in the larger camps. So we've been working on different ways to prevent this or to retard this deterioration. This has been done a long time ago in Greenland, the gravel ramp at Tuto, which is 30 feet wide to begin with and a little over 16,000 feet long, was quite successful for several years. It consisted of a 3 to 4 foot fill of locally obtained gravel, which was nice to have handy. About 5 years after the road was constructed, it was about 40 feet in some places above the surrounding ice and had become impassable because of shoulder slumping had made it too narrow. Other materials have been successfully used. Sawdust is very excellent if you're fortunate enough to be in an area where it is acquirable. This was used for the parking lot and a lot of the road facilities during the Winter Olympics at Squaw Valley. Problem is sawdust and other materials like that, sand and gravel and so forth, are not easily available in the polar regions, and the bulk is a pretty serious problem as far as shipping is concerned. So we've done a lot of work with urethane foams, also some experimental work with dirt and rock fill. Maybe I'd better catch one or two of the first slides here, please. Hope they come out right. These are the results of tests of various layers of gravel on snow and ice surfaces under laboratory conditions in which temperature was controlled and solar radiation was simulated by infrared lamps. Although they're also using other materials, the urethane granules, the plastic, and it simply shows that under similar conditions, the natural urethane granules, A3, are pretty good. The F1 is unprotected ice, and it shows that it melted away very drastically. And the B4 material, which was, again, a natural urethane granules, they're small grains, sort of like a sand, probably the most efficient in protecting the material or protecting the snow and ice surfaces. This could also, under some circumstances, apply to frozen ground. The urethane slabs and granules, however, are fine as long as they're left undisturbed. They have very poor wind resistance and very poor traffic resistance. So this, again, is another problem. We've done a little bit of field work on using both fiberglass and metal pierced planking, sort of like the old Marston matting, placed over layers of urethane sheeting, both flexible and rigid. And this does, in fact, work real fine. This is very excellent. But again, depending upon the size of the area you need to protect, there's a certain amount of expense and labor involved, which I don't think it'd be too good for a full-scale runway unless it was something that really was drastically needed for a short road or for a large campsite. It would work just fine. Now, next slide. Here's the sawdust at Squaw Valley from the parking lot for the Winter Olympics. Next slide. These are some of the applications of the granulated urethane foam and snow mixture. It illustrates that the foam itself does not have good wind resistance. It's light and fluffy, and it blows away easily. Although as a mixture, if it's mixed, say, one-to-one with snow, it does do better, and it forms a better protective surface. Part of the problem in areas of extreme melt where you do get puddling, then the foam will float on the puddles. This is all right if it stays there because it reduces the absorption of solar radiation in the water and helps retard further melting. Drainage, of course, in an area, especially in the Arctic, where puddling water can occur in a campsite on snow or especially ice. Snow is permeable. It doesn't happen too much on snow. But if you can provide and maintain good drainage, this can mean a lot in maintaining a usable ice surface, especially a road or a runway. Other materials have been used more or less on a temporary basis. Sheets of canvas, almost anything like that will protect an area. Again, the problem in the polar regions in the extreme Arctic or the Antarctic is that of logistics and transportation. And if you can use natural materials, you're much better off. And snow itself is one of the best materials. It's a good insulator and it has a high albedo. It reflects a great deal of incoming solar radiation. The trouble is, the snow gets older, it becomes more granular, and its efficiency as an insulating material and as a reflector decreases with time, and also as the summer goes on. But this can be reestablished artificially. Next slide, please. One of the big problems here at Outer Williams Field in Antarctica, this is an alternate ice runway. It's about 14 miles by road from McMurdo Station, which is located right in here behind the building. This is Observation Hill and Castle Rock on Hut Point Peninsula with Mount Erebus in the background. This is the Navy's main base for logistic support for all the scientific research in the Antarctic. McMurdo has a population, a summertime population of about 1,000 men. Williams Field is located out on the McMurdo ice shelf far in the background. And it's the base where the ski wheel equipped Hercules cargo aircraft operate to resupply the inland stations. And this airfield is an alternate ice airfield for wheeled aircraft only. The constellations that are not capable of a ski wheel configuration, they have to land on wheels. And later in the season, the annual sea ice runway becomes unsafe. And so this runway, some of the Hercules, the New Zealand Hercules, does not have skis on it also. So there's a need for an alternate runway for wheeled aircraft. And this area was selected. At first glance, it was beautiful. It was vast mile after mile of hard, blue, relatively smooth glacier ice with thin, patchy snow drifts. And it really looked good. But this sort of gave rise to what I call Page's Law. Anytime something looks too good to be true, there's something wrong. This area, under these blue areas of ice, low albedo ice, about 45 to 50%, sometimes up to 60%, starting in mid-December, subsurface melting occurs. And this melting starts at depths of 18 to 26 or 30 inches, and it's never detectable by eye. And melt pools form that are circular or oval in shape. Their configuration is determined by the configuration and size of surface high albedo snowdrifts that survive through the summer. This internal melting starts out, the ice becomes corn ice, and the melting continues, and you develop a subsurface melt pool in this area. It happens over quite a large area. The ice over the melt pool, which would be this blue ice, gets as thin as 3 inches. Usually it's a little thicker. But again, these are never detectable by eye. The water never comes to the surface. It always looks good. And yet a heavily loaded aircraft wheel will break into these. And they're sometimes as much as a meter deep, and will span 3 or 4 feet deep, and will span a circular area up to 70 feet. And so these things occur. They begin in early December and reach their peak in early January. And then as the wintertime comes, the subsurface water again begins to freeze up. But they're real tricky, and here we thought we had it made for a runway. So anyway, we found by artificially producing a high albedo surface, I think this shows on the next slide. This was done by using wheel-mounted, next slide please. This again shows the blue surface of the runway. I can't tell whether it's in focus. Not, but by using a wheel-mounted pulver mixers, which consist of a drum covered with teeth, and they're used originally for mixing soil cement and certain highway projects, by producing a layer, even a layer a half an inch thick, of white, chipped and powdered ice mixed with whatever snow is there, and maintaining it on the runway completely prevented any subsurface melting. And this subsurface melting is obviously a very delicate balance between albedo and air temperatures and incoming solar radiation. But the full-scale runway was built and maintained by pulver mixing and maintaining a very white insulating surface, and it worked completely in this area. In some Arctic regions, it's possible to use sand and gravel, and it may be possible to import artificial materials like some of the urethane foams and slabs. Next slide, I think, if there are any more. Again, this is the annual sea ice runway in McMurdo Station, where they also have problems, or did have, because it was easy to establish a runway. It was simply a matter of removing the few inches of drift snow, scraping it right down to sea ice. But as summer came on, the sea ice, again, was a dark blue ice. It had a low albedo, absorbed a great deal of solar radiation energy, and developed a zone of weakness, which is an entirely different thing from what happened in the glacier ice. The problem here, there's a great deal of traffic and activity as the cargo planes were brought in and unloaded, and a great deal of dirt, little drops of oil, anything like that. Any one little drop of oil can make a pothole 2 feet wide and a foot deep in just a couple of days in the sea ice. And this makes rough landing, and the pilots get unhappy, and things like that. So they found here again that the easiest maintenance procedure was merely to maintain a surface of snow a couple of inches deep and to keep it as white and clean as possible. Later on in the season, the sea ice thins by bottom melting, and it eventually gets too thin to support an aircraft, and all operations go to Outer Williams Field. But again, this operation here, they're spreading and rolling snow on the runway instead of taking it off. They found by that this is the best way to maintain it. Next slide, I think, unless this is the last one. Oh, this is a rubber tire mounted pulver mixer. There's a large drum here that rotates at a high rate of speed, and it has metal teeth on it that pulverize and chip and powder the ice, and it effectively changes blue bubbly ice, which absorbs a great deal of radiation. It produces a surface of powdered ice and chipped ice, which in turn the albedo goes up to 76 or 80%, and it is an excellent protective surface and can be maintained. Sometimes you might have to re-pulver mix twice a week in certain areas, but at least this is easier than any other means in this area of maintaining a usable ice surface. Okay, I think that's the last slide now. Next slide. Oh, this This is the shear strength of sea ice, and it illustrates the effect of a snow cover. The low strength samples were run during the season through December, January, and February on the sea ice runway. This was during the process of trying to convince the Navy that they should maintain a snow cover, and we were able to show that the shear strength does drop. It gets weaker because of the absorbed solar radiation, the temperature rise, and the internal deterioration of the sea ice. In areas where, say, a large permanent snowdrift occurred, a few inches thick, we ran other samples and were able to show that the strength stayed a lot higher. Okay, next slide. I guess that's the last slide. Lights, please. Again, in conclusion, where logistics permit, many artificial materials can be used to protect the snow or ice surface during the summer ablation and melt season. Where this cannot be done, or where it's not possible to ship in, even though the best of the urethane or the foam materials are bulky and have many problems, and sometimes you can produce the foam in the field by making a mix and then it foams in time. You're familiar with this, but all these have problems of use and logistics. So when this cannot be done, when artificial methods are not feasible or not economic, why, simply by remembering to maintain a highly reflective layer on a snow or ice surface and maintaining good drainage, a snow camp or a camp on the ice or travel routes, runways, roads, whatnot on ice and snow surfaces can often be maintained and kept usable even in areas of severe ablation. That's all I have here. If there's any questions, Mr. Page, or the, yeah, I'll be coming up.
The man you listened to is Russell A. Page, a geologist with the Polar Division of the U.S. Naval Civil Engineering Laboratory at Port Hueneme, California, and we'll hear from him later on in the program also. I think we should congratulate Ms. Steele on having slides, graphs, that can be read. This is something that many people forget when they're preparing illustrations for presentation orally. They present the graphs which are designed for the publication rather than for oral presentation. Are there any questions? Yes.
Hi, Mr. Cola. So that I summarized the page and you roll it. Does it very fact that you polymerize it and lend itself to compaction so you have a stable surface or tires, whatever?
Pretty good. Right after folding, it is rolled with a wobble wheel rubber tire roller. It compacts pretty good. Again, though, this act of compaction reduces, in a sense, its insulating value. It doesn't have any effect on the albedo. But again, the problem is with these runways, even after folding the mix, and the next hard blow, the next hard wind, will strip this stuff off. And this is one of the problems. Even a good compaction, large areas of the runway carry will remain stable, but still the little area of the wind scours away the white, scours it down the blue ice, and just when the storm blew away and the next day of sunshine, you start getting internal melting. So they go right out of the pole and they keep the bare area. It's sort of a rat race if you need to get some area.
I think we'll have to move ahead to the next paper. In the next two papers, we're going to have an exception to the rule. We're all acquainted with a case where the professor presents a paper based on the graduate student's research. In the case of the next two papers, we're going to have the graduate students presenting papers, and I understand that Professor Carl Benson and Professor Weller are both out in the field doing research. I'm sure that Mr. Dennis Talbot, who's presenting this next paper, has done most of the research on the paper. I don't mean to imply that he's reporting on the professor's paper, but to a certain extent, since the professor is listed in the title, you can assume that he has had some part in it also. But we have the case of the graduate student presenting the professor's paper this time. Mr. Talbot.
I think the first thing I should mention is that there is a mistake in the program. You can tell by my graduate student salary that I am no professor. And so we get started right from there. And I would also like to thank the other two speakers for laying a fine background for what I had to say. I believe only the title of my talk is published in the bulletin. It's Physical Thermal Processes of Snow Cover in Interior Alaska. Just a little thought will reveal to most of you that snow cover covers the surface of the earth and actually forms the surface of the earth in interior Alaska for at least half, if not three quarters of the year. So the snow cover itself is what people live on, what construction projects have to work through or over or on top of, and it's just part of the environment, and people have to be concerned with the snow cover, the physical processes that affect the physical properties that are the snow cover. I think I should begin first by defining this term in the title, Interior Alaska. I think Mr. Mayo did a fairly good job. He showed you his map with the climatic zones in it. And with any kind of luck, I'll show you one. Yes, not quite as clear, I'm afraid. But here is a map of Alaska. The interior basin, if I may borrow this. The interior basin is outlined here in the dark.
Can you see it? Shall we cut the lights?
Is it visible? Good. It's bounded on three sides climatically by large mountain ranges, the Brooks Range, the Cochrane Hills, and Kuskokwim Mountains, and of course the Alaska Range. And over here it's bounded climatically by the large expanses of Canadian territory. Within this area, we have the Tanana drainage system, the Yukon drainage system, three or four major river systems, and the low rolling uplands that separate these systems. All fairly low territory, as Mr. Mayo pointed out. This area includes what has been termed the cold pole of the United States, or of continental United States. As you can see, this is a map of the mean maximum temperatures for January, and the minus 10 contour is right around Fort Yukon. Fairbanks is in this area. So the cold pole of continental United States lies within this area, and the whole area, as Mr. Mayo pointed out, has been classified as subpolar continental climatically. So we expect low precipitation values in this area. At least the Weather Bureau figures I have gave less than 12 inches of rainfall per year, and of which at least half falls as snowfall. So we get a maximum snow cover around here of maybe 50 to 70 centimeters. As it shows up there, the average monthly temperature for January can be around minus 11. We reach minus 45 degrees Fahrenheit almost every winter, and minus 50 is not uncommon. Within this climatic zone are developed two principal end members in types of snow. In low topographic areas, we get low density, large crystalline depth hoar snow, very unconsolidated, loose and fluffy. In the higher areas, we get higher density snow, up to 0.4, 0.45, highly wind crusted, highly indurated, the type of snow you can almost walk on the surface. The principal cause of this is the large, stable masses of cold air that collect in the valley systems. Thermal inversions up to 30 degrees per 100 meters have been measured by Dr. Benson within the Fairbanks area. And so, with this, it becomes obvious that in the low-lying areas, the temperatures can be very cold, the air very still, and with elevation, the temperatures become warmer, and there are almost constant winds throughout the winter. Around here, even the surrounding hills, some of the higher hills poke through this inversion layer. The inversion layer runs from 100 meters to 150 meters in thickness. On top of these hills, we see the effects of the wind blowing and the wind crusting and higher density snow is developed there. Because of the cold, stable air masses that lie in the valley areas, the surface of the snow is subjected to very low temperatures. We have measured soil-snow interface temperatures and find that the soil-snow interface temperature very rarely falls below minus 5 degrees C. The surface of the snow almost every winter falls below minus 50. With combine these two figures with the shallow snowpack, it's not uncommon to measure a temperature gradient through the snow of 1 degree per centimeter. We have measured 2 degrees per centimeter, which indicates that snow is itself a very good insulator, as was indicated in the other talks. This also produces a very unstable situation within the snowpack. With the warm temperatures at the bottom, and of course the vapor pressure of water over ice being a function of temperature, we have higher vapor pressures at the bottom of the snowpack and much lower vapor pressures at the upper portions of the snowpack. Mass redistribution is almost impossible to prevent in a situation like this. Let's see. Most of the former workers that have observed depth hoar formation, which is the result of this mass distribution process, have blamed it on a diffusion process. It has always been considered that the difference in the vapor pressures through the process of diffusion resulted in the growth of the crystals at the bottom because of the deterioration and removal of other materials and the decreasing of the density at the basal portions, and thus making the snowpack very, very unconsolidated, very fluffy. Well, let's look at the two cases. At the higher altitudes, where the wind blows, the process of diffusion is helped by the pumping of the wind. As the wind blows over the snowpack, there are pressure differences, and the air is actually pumped in and out of the snowpack. And so the air being saturated within the snowpack mass is moved up and down in the snowpack, and of course is deposited in the upper parts of the snowpack where the vapor pressure is much lower and the temperature is much lower. In the valley areas where there are no winds, we have to look for some other mechanism for the redistribution. Our density measurements indicate that mass is redistributed at the rate of probably a hundredth of a gram per square centimeter per day and up to 0.07 of a gram per square centimeter per day. According to the calculations we have made and using pure diffusion models of Yen, Giddings and LaChapelle, and Bader in the early days, we've used all three of these men's calculated diffusion models, and we find that our recorded values that we find in our density measurements are fully an order of magnitude greater than predicted by these pure diffusion models. What then is the explanation? We have no wind to help pump the material. We turn to convection. If we consider the snowpack and the large temperature gradient that is through the snowpack, it must become fairly obvious that the cold dense air is at the top of the snowpack and the warm, less dense air is at the bottom. And so there would naturally seem to be convective currents within the snowpack. To check this hypothesis, last winter, we laid thin, impermeable polyethylene sheets within the snowpack. We tried to catch them at natural stratigraphic horizons about every 10 centimeters, so we got as undisturbed a snowpack as possible. So we put these polyethylene sheets, fairly large, 5 by 20 meters, within the snowpack about every 10 centimeters, and ended up with this massive polyethylene snow sandwich. While we were installing the sheets, we also put in thermocouples, so we had a chance to look at relatively undisturbed temperatures in this area and thermocouple probes in the unmodified snow. By comparing these two temperature profiles, we found that the temperature profile in the polyethylene sandwich was nearly linear, which indicated to us, at least, that the process of heat transfer within the polyethylene sandwich was mainly by conduction and not by convection, not producing high and low temperature zones and small conduction cells. We did some calculations on these temperature profiles, and we found that the rate of heat transfer through the snowpack is almost doubled by this convective effect. We measured approximately 8 calories per centimeter per day transferred through the polyethylene sandwich, and up to 16 calories per square centimeter per day in the unmodified snow patches. So, as a consequence of this short and slightly brief study, we have found that mass and latent heat transport within the snowpack are greatly enhanced by the presence of convective activity, and that by no means can all of the mass transfer that is attributed to diffusional processes be so attributed to diffusional processes. There has to be some other method of mass transfer. In addition to this, work is presently going on not only on confirming this work, we are also working on isotopic fractionization in the lower parts of the snowpack. We hope Ted Freeman will find out for us anyway when he runs the samples. We hope that the solid state distillation that goes on in this mass transfer process will fractionate the stable isotopes of hydrogen and oxygen, and we should see the cleaner materials being left in the lower parts of the snowpack and the concentration of the dirty materials up in the upper parts of the snowpack. I think that's about all I have to say, except that I would like to point out that in relation to Miss Steele's talk, I'll probably get myself in trouble, but I think this crushed ice cover way of preventing deteriorations of frozen materials below, I think we should all be cautioned that this will probably not work on areas that overlie ground surfaces because of the great heat flux that comes up, and because of what I've just pointed out, the large and rapid development of depth hoar. In the interior of Alaska, our 50 to 70 centimeters of snow will be completely converted to depth hoar by the end of the season. Crystals of over a centimeter in diameter in the bottom part of the snowpack and well over 5 millimeters in the upper portions of the snowpack. And so a crushed ice roadway up here, I'm afraid, would deteriorate from the bottom almost as quickly as from the top. Although it is fine on glacier ice where you don't have quite the heat flux from the bottom. Thank you.
Well, I think you'll all agree that we are indebted to Mr. Treiber for a very fine paper, which not only reports on important research, but he's checking the theories of some of the leading theoreticians in the area and correcting their faults, and that's what we need to do by observing the situation in the field. Are there any questions for Mr. Treiber? Yes.
Did the last statement to imply then that the snow road this winter would not work if it were constructed out of pure ice and snow? Well, last year, that it gets a lot of way, I understand, were gouged out of the tundra.
Well, for one thing, it got started late in the season, so they didn't have a lot of time to work, and I know that they removed most of the snow from the center as they made the highway. I suspect that they tried to build the road by mounting snow. It's hard to say because I suspect it would last through the season and would surely melt in summer. So the time for to make its effect felt when you start making potholes in the road probably wouldn't be long enough. If you try to make a summer road by mounting up enough snow to make it last through the summer, I suspect that for it would make itself felt and the road would deteriorate.
Any other comments or questions? The next paper on our list is stream freezing in the North Slope, which is Professor Carl Benson's paper. And as I mentioned before, Dr. Benson is in the field at the present time. And Mr. Jerry Kretschner, whom I understand is a former graduate student of Mr. Benson's and now with Union Oil Company, is this correct? Will present this paper. Mr. Jerry Kretschner.
Well, I hope everything comes off here like I planned it. I had about 5 minutes to plan this. And I just got into town. I haven't had time to even register for the convention. Dr. Carl Benson and myself did some research on stream freezing, and not like the title indicates, we didn't do it on the North Slope, but we did it about 5 miles north of the university here. But we think that we have the same type of conditions out there, and the same type of icing problems that you would have up on the North Slope. So I'll just get right into my slides here because I have quite a few of them to go through. If we can have the lights. The stream icing starts around the 1st of October, and this is out at Goldstream Creek, which is just 5 miles north of the university here. The ice starts forming at the sides on any shallow part in the stream. This ice can be anywhere from a C-axis horizontal to a vertical ice, depending on the nucleating crystal. There is a thin skim of ice all over the whole stream right now. Here we are a little bit later. This is about the 6th of October. The water depth has increased. And in here, you can see the frazzle ice. The entire bottom of this stream is completely filled with ice. It's very mushy. It slows down the velocity of the stream, increases the height, and oftentimes could cause an overflow at this early stream bottom here. And you can see there's rock and gravel up on top of the ice. And this ice was frozen to the bottom and peeled off and turned over, and it is quite an eroding factor. This is the first ice of the season, this thin skim ice under polarized light. The blue area here